Welcome to Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Leah D'Amato with us. Leah is a physical therapist specializing in women's pelvic health, including pregnancy and pediatrics, and is committed to empowering her patients using active recovery to improve their health and quality of life. Leah also sustained a severe concussion a year and a half ago, which she has been slowly recovering from. So Leah, let's start by introducing yourself. Tell us about you and how did you become a physio and what motivates you to keep going?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on your podcast. I'm really happy to be here. So how I started to become a physical therapist. So back when I was doing my undergrad degree, I knew I always wanted to help people. And that's really where it stemmed from. And I knew I wanted to give back and help people when on whatever journey that they were on. And as I went through my schooling, I slowly realized that physio, we call physiotherapy here in Canada, which you guys call physical therapy, was a perfect avenue for me. So it's a 2 years master's degree for us here after finishing your undergrad. And during my master's degree, I started to learn a little bit about women's health, and specifically pelvic health physiotherapy, which is a relatively new area here in Canada. And how it works is you have to be rostered. So it's a special kind of part of physiotherapy that you can have, but you need to do special training for it. And it's only been in place since 2012. And so it's been a relatively new area that's starting to grow and learn, but there's so much to be shared and so much to learn about, which is what I'm trying to help others and learn through this process. And so early on through my master's degree, I knew I wanted to do pelvic health, just knowing how much potential there is and the quality of evidence to substantiate and say how much it can improve or cure your symptoms and things such as incontinence. And so I do that. And then so part of my time, I'd work at the World of My Baby. It's a private practice for pelvic health. And then my other half of the time, I also love working in pediatrics. And so I work at, it's actually Canada's largest pediatric facility in Toronto called Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital. And so I alternate between those two roles, and I've blended pelvic health in both areas, actually. So that is my background as to how I started that. And over the years, I've grown to really specialize in perinatal care, so looking through even from before birth, so from conception and infertility to early on during pregnancy and through the all three trimesters, and then what I call your fourth trimester once you've had your child and recovering in that area. So that's a big area of my specialization. And then I also do pediatric pelvic health and things such as potty training, for example, which is a big area that moms need to learn about it. And though it sounds easy, it's not a simple feat. So that's a little bit about me. I don't know if there's any other specific questions before we dive in.
Well, we're going to have many.
Yes.
We've got a list.
But yeah, that's kind of a bit about me.
Lovely. Well, so we'd love to start, because you mentioned before that in a previous conversation that you had bad concussion, which for martial arts is really a big issue, and there's lots of scientific research out there. I think there was one that said actually women suffered worse than guys did, which is quite new, I think, quite new research. But you have experienced it, and we know that it's been quite difficult. Like, just getting better from it is a really tough thing. And we'd love, maybe first, if you could just break down actually what concussion is for the audience, and also then maybe talk about your experience and why it's dangerous and how, yeah, that road to recovery that you've had.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, concussion is a mild brain injury. And I'm going to start with debunking a myth, which was new to me when I found out about my concussion. And being a physio, it was so eye-opening how much we don't realize and how much the research has changed, but yet not in practice. in that you don't need to hit your head to have a concussion. It's really this quick maneuver of going forward and back. So even whiplash through the neck can create the concussion. So that is a quite common thing that people think, oh, I didn't hit my head, I don't have one. That isn't necessarily the case. And for myself, it was kind of a combination of that, in which I was at work, working at the hospital. This happened in the summer of 2019. So it's been over a year and a half at this point. And I was just crouched down, actually cleaning a walker. And as I stood up, I hit the base of my neck, more so the kind of the base of the head or the neck area, on the top of the bottom of a cabinet door. And so I hit my head. I was like, ooh, I don't feel good, but kind of just went on about my day. I had a really busy work day and didn't think much of it. I did have a headache. And so concussions are so variable. And that's what makes things so tricky in regards to the symptoms that you experience and when it comes on and how long it takes as well. And so initially I just had a headache and I thought, you know what, I'll just take an Advil, I'll be okay. And then later on that day and over the next day, I started to notice some other symptoms that were kind of subtle and I didn't even think about as a concussion really. So things like I was just sleeping more and I felt tired. And then you hear this a lot where you just don't feel right. And it's very difficult to explain, but if you've had a concussion, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so I started to just feel like something's wrong, but I don't know what it is. And so 2 days later, and I had been working through this, I was like, okay, I need to really figure out what's happening. This isn't okay. And so I went to my family doctor, and that's when she diagnosed me with a mild brain injury, which is also known as a concussion. And she said to just go home and rest. And so I rested for a period of time, and then things got worse. And then I ended up in that dark room with no lights, no sounds. And I was in there for about a month, which led to a cycle of different symptoms, really a whole range. They have kind of four areas of symptoms. So they have your physical symptoms, which are things like your headaches, your neck pain, your vision changes. You have your emotional changes, so crying all the time, the depression, the anxiety piece. You have sleep changes, so either sleeping too much or not being able to sleep at all. And then the cognitive changes, so difficulty concentrating, the sensitivity to noise and light, all of those things. And so I really had all of it that had blown up over the first month of my recovery. And typically with research, 70% of people get better within the first few days to week, and really up to that month period. And then 10 to 30% go on to have symptoms, which the term has changed. And so you may hear it as what's called post-concussion syndrome or persistent concussion symptoms. There's different things, but typically it's termed PCS. And if you fall within that 10 to 30% range of having PCS, there's no known time when you'll recover. And what that recovery will look like. And so as I fell into this other smaller percentage, it became really tricky to know how to navigate the healthcare system and how to help myself get better. And they, to this day, they don't truly know why there are some women or some who have PCS, but there are some theories and different reasons to it. And one thing that I mentioned to you both on our last chat was that women tend to have more severe concussions and fall more within this kind of PCS component of it as well. And there's some hypothetical theories, and I've done a lot of research, and there's just not enough in it yet. So I'm hoping clinicians will start to look more into this, is hormones and the menstrual cycle, because there is a component of that, but it hasn't been documented enough to know what is the effect and how that changes, but that is one piece of it. So anyways, so through my recovery for the past year and a half, I've really dived into many different areas of my health and looking at things such as naturopathic care, so my gut health, looking at sleep and how to improve that, my physical components, so how to return to exercise. I was a really active person. I used to swim. I used to dance. I used to go to do weightlifting. I did everything. Every day was something. And I went to doing absolutely nothing. And to this day, I have made a lot of progress and I'm really happy, but exercise is something I still have a difficult time with because I just have a lot of energy deficits, meaning I can only get so much done in a day. And then once my energy's done, just like your phone battery, then that's all you can do. And so it's a bit about pacing and planning your days, which are also energy conservation techniques, which are important for a lot of different people for a lot of different things. But I think one of the big things that I learned is that there are so many people out there who don't know what's really necessary and important for concussion. So things like now what research says is after your first 48 hours of having your concussion, you need to gradually be integrating back into your community and going back out to what you used to do. So whether that's going back to school or going back to your sport or work and kind of returning back to that versus being isolated in that dark room, which 10 years ago is what we were all prescribed to do. So that's a big one that hasn't been really talked about or used to be talked about, that dark room, and now isn't the case. And the other thing is, I always highlight this now to whoever I talk to, is even if you're not sure, be safe and just get it checked out right away. It's not worth waiting. And my hypothesis as to part of why mine's taken so long is the fact that I worked on it for the first 2 days and I didn't give my brain the rest it needed initially. And those first that first 1 to 2 days is really when you need to rest and then start to work on recovery. And I kind of did the vice versa of it because that's just what I was told and I didn't know better. And I'm a physiotherapist who has training and I learned a little bit about this in school. So it goes to say how much really there is to learn and how many people have reached out to me being like, I had no idea and nobody knows how to help me. And there's just so many areas to kind of explore and dive into. But I think my biggest piece is when in doubt, get it checked out and make sure you have clinicians who are going through the evidence-based care and not telling you to go into a dark room because that is not the answer.
So I was going to, sorry. So I was going to say, like, what does recovery look like though? So you say like you should rest your brain. Mm-hmm. But then actually, what does active recovery, going back into society, but does it mean like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, very good question. So it's a gradual return to work or return to sport or school in the sense that you may just be doing 1 hour per day and then you're gradually building back up. So it's increasing the stimulus and the things that are bothersome to you. So for instance, a light sensitivity. Instead of being in a dark room, you're going to gradually start to expose yourself to more light and be in that room. And it may not be a full day right off the bat. And that's why having clinicians help guide you through that process is so important. And it's very varied per person. And so it's hard to really give a pinpoint of how much on each given day. There's no set protocol, but really it's like gradual progression and desensitization, I almost say, with different things like noise and sound, and then the cognitive piece or the physical piece. So there is a test that you do, a physical test. It's called the Buffalo Treadmill Test, and they put you on there and they're trying to get your max heart rate, and you go on for about, well, it depends on how long it takes to get your heart rate up. So mine was over 25 minutes. And they're trying to see if you're able to do that and clear without having symptoms. And that's when you're able to do exercise freely. But up until that point, it's a very slow, gradual process. And you're starting with just simple walking. So for me, it was walking for 2 minutes and in my basement and just doing that. And then taking a break to let my symptoms settle and then try it again. And so it's really a walking program from the physical end, but it applies to all aspects of gradually progressing those areas that are difficult for you and bring on those symptoms and going through that part too. And having that support system to help guide you through it, because when you're in it, it's very difficult and it's so overwhelming having those symptoms and also being afraid to bring on the symptoms, which goes to speak more to that mental health piece where, for one, you're anxious because it's the worst feeling ever. Like you hate it. You hate your life. And then I also felt, and I know a lot of us do, you feel a loss of identity. And I was almost grieving my own self in the sense that I went from this super active, very busy, doing so much to absolutely nothing. And so then you have to work through the psychological piece of that. And that's when I had my neuropsychologist who really helped reframe what's safe and how do we progress that being in a safe environment, but not being stuck where we can't do anything. And also learning principles of changing our mindset and how we believe things and, you know, that this won't be forever and that there are ways to improve it in a gradual way. So that what we call cognitive behavioral therapy is what we did. And it was very effective. And there is research to substantiate that in many different mental health issues, but for what I went through for sure as well.
And like what, biologically, what's happened to your brain? Like what does a brain injury mean? Does it mean like you break some blood vessels and there's a bit of blood going around in there? Is it bruising? Like what does it, how does it manifest? And
yeah, that's a really good question.
What's it actually doing to your brain?
I'm probably not the right person to ask this because it's not my specialty and I don't know the full anatomy of what's happening. And there, depending on where you look, there's different answers. So they don't for sure know, but there's this, what they call a coup counter coup, and which means that the brain actually moves in the skull forward and backwards, and that high velocity movement causes a diffusion of injury through that area. But I can't give you the specific nitty gritties, unfortunately, because I just truthfully don't know it well enough and I don't want to give the wrong information. But I was taught that. I can't remember now.
That's fine. No, thank you.
Just a quick one. So if, let's say you did not go to check it up. So after you felt a little weird, you said it's going to get better and I'm not going to check it. What would be the implications then?
So it's varied. It depends on the person. So for the 70% of people, even if they kind of just wait it out for the first month, they get better and then it's fine. But if you're within that 10 to 30% past that 1 month period of recovery and you don't do anything, the symptoms can get worse and it can really limit your quality of life and what you can do from day to day, in the sense that you may not be able to do things like go to the grocery store because it'll be so light out and there's so many sounds. Be able to have conversation with people because there's just too much noise and it's hard to concentrate. I would say that it, for that group, that subset, it can make things quite challenging and that these symptoms can persist for a very long time. And I've talked to a lot of others who fall within what you're mentioning, who never went to get help. And there are 5 years, 10 years, and have thought that they had to live with this. And the reality is, no matter how far along you are, there is still things that you can do to get better. And it's still always good to go even at that point, but it won't go away on its own. And the reality is, if it's not one of those things where just push past the pain, it's going to get better. It's actually the reverse. If you push too much, it's going to get worse. And that was so hard for me because I'm a very type A go, go, go getter. And so I would push myself too much on a regular basis, knowing that I need to be slow at the process and even having these principles of just how to gradually progress any program, having gone through that training and my physio program. But I just wanted to do more. I wanted to be back to my normal, and I'm not normal. And so I would push and then you crash and then you can't do anything. And I'd be stuck in bed for days and I can't even walk and go up the stairs. And then I would try to do it again and then I'd crash. And then you kind of go through these ebbs and flows. And for people who don't have the right clinicians to guide you through that process, it's even worse. And those energy conservation principles are so important of planning your day and knowing what takes more energy out and what you're going to prioritize. All of those principles, which is what I worked a lot with my occupational therapist.
Absolutely. It's a very humbling experience when things that we all take for granted, like being able to go upstairs and being able to do all of this stuff, suddenly gets taken away. It's really scary.
It is. It really puts things in perspective and how much we can do on a day-to-day basis and not realize. And then for myself, even being a clinician and having working with others who are in that boat and knowing how challenging it is to be on a journey where you feel that you're no longer yourself, and how do I get back to doing it when you've had all these horrible experiences and these negative times. And so it really just put things in perspective and learning how to build back things like resiliency and working through it, and learning different skills and tools to help through that process. So I've really grown to love mindfulness, self-compassion. And I think it's something everyone can really practice. We're always our worst own critic. And that inner self-dialogue can be so difficult at times. And being able to just, you know, whatever you did, better is better, is what I say. How much better is not what's important right now. It's just taking that little step forward. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. And having gone through that process, I can really understand now sometimes when my clients are going through on their journeys, whether it's pelvic pain or infertility or whatever else that is, because it is very challenging and it's never going to be that linear progress of recovery. It's that, you know, full craziness to get to that point. So,
yeah. And I think that I think, as you said, the ebbs and flows. I think anyone who's got any kind of condition ever, even with like a sports injury, on just a really, really simple level, which is going to definitely get better. You don't actually have to do anything. In fact, doing nothing is probably the best thing. And one day you think it's better and the next day it's like, no, I can't walk on it. No, I tried to jump. Don't jump. Sit down. As well as more like severe mental and sort of, you know, organ issues. And are you developing support in this field? I think we talked a little bit about it before.
Yeah, so through my experience early on, I mentioned I felt loss of my identity and what I did, and I really loved helping people. And so knowing that I couldn't clinically do anything, I wanted to be able to just educate on a concussion and everything that I've learned and all the research that I did, because there's others out there who don't have the same level of education and don't even know how to access healthcare. And that was such a difficult journey and a part of that journey for me. And so through my social media, I started to just gradually start to develop a bit of a platform and teach others about concussions and simple myths that needed to be debunked. Through my journey, I also just as a form of self-documentation of how I've progressed, so I can look back that, yes, right now I'm not able to, let's say, for instance, swim, but I'm now back to working and socializing a bit. And so I also did it as a form of, you know, hope that things get better and that you won't be there forever, because sometimes it's hard to have that perspective when you've been in it for so long. And so I've had a lot of just people in the community locally and globally reach out to me, and it's been so nice to have that. And I've also just connected with so many others who've gone through the same thing, or different clinicians who offer services to learn more about what's available out there. So I've blended that with what I do now, and I'm back to, which I'm so happy because it's truly my passion, is pelvic health and women's health. And so I kind of blend it with it all together on my Instagram and social media.
That's so helpful. I mean, going through it makes you have a different perspective. And that's, yeah, you did the right thing. Let's talk about pelvic health, because that's what you specialize in. Can you start by explaining what exactly this encompasses?
For sure. So pelvic health is really a wide range of things. And even for the population, you go from children with pediatric pelvic health conditions all the way to menopause and beyond. And it's for women and for men. So although women have a vagina and men have a penis, there is also male pelvic physio. So it's for everyone. What pelvic health covers is, so we have our pelvis. Our pelvis is a small bowl at the base, which really is the core of our body. And in that area, we have muscles, we have ligaments, and we have organs and fascia. And so in that area, it's important for things such as our bladder control, our bowel control, our sexual health, our circulation system. So it's a sub pump motion. It does a variety of different things. And so these are all things a pelvic health physical therapist would do. And so some examples of some things we see are things like constipation or hemorrhoids, incontinence, whether that be with coughing, sneezing, laughing, or jumping, or you have the urgency to go to the washroom and you don't make it in time. Things like a prolapse, a pelvic organ prolapse, a diastasis recti. There's so many different things that we cover. And it's a lot of those TMI, which I say there's no TMI. It's that hush-hush taboo topic that I think is so important and needs to be talked more about. And it's really throughout a lifespan, as I mentioned. So from when kids are small and things like bedwetting, for example, it's a really big issue that kids don't grow out of, and if they have bedwetting, it needs to be worked on. It's called dysfunctional voiding. To when they're teenagers and young adults and having things like painful intercourse with things like vaginismus, and then having diagnoses like endometriosis or vaginismus or vulvodynia, and then if they want to become pregnant and having infertility like PCOS and again endometriosis, and then becoming pregnant and then going through that pregnancy into then postpartum and then in menopause with the changes of hormones. So there's really so much that we do. And what I always say is we treat people, not conditions. And so it's not just what's happening at the pelvis. It's what's happening in the whole body. It's a very holistic practice, especially the way I practice. And so it's also looking at things like, how are you eating? How are you sleeping? How are you moving? How is your mental health? Because what is now known is that our nervous system is hardwired with our pelvic floor. And so to address our nervous system is looking at our pillars of health, which are things like I mentioned, our diet, our sleep, our movement, the mental health piece, all of those are important. And so pelvic health is a lot, but in essence, that's kind of what we cover into that pelvic floor region and all the conditions that can come with it.
That's so interesting what you said about how your nervous system is linked in, like that holistic approach. I used to get phantom pain in my pelvis and I was incredibly stressed at the time. And they checked me out and then they were like, you're fine. Like, you've got nothing wrong with you. And I was like, but I have like pain. And they were like, yeah it's nothing medical. And it's okay now, because but it's a stress thing. And that's like where I store my stress and my angst and stuff. Yeah. And that makes so much sense. Yeah, what's what I do. I don't know about other.
No, it's actually for women, it is probably the most common area that we carry our stress and our tension and we don't realize it. It's a very subconscious thing because we're protective, and that's, when you think about it, that's where we pee, that's where we poo, that's where we have sex, that's where we can, like, all these really important health things are coming from there. So of course we're going to want to protect it. And so it's through the pelvic region, it's through that upper neck region, I find, and in through the calves. Those are areas, and our jaws are related to our pelvic floors too. And when we talk about birth, I can explain that more. Mm-hmm.
My brain is exploding. I get jaw ache when I grind my teeth when I'm stressed
Me
as well.
Too.
And I get really tight shoulders.
Yes. So that's all of the nervous system, right? So we have what's called our autonomic nervous system. And in our autonomic nervous system, we have our parasympathetic nervous system and our sympathetic nervous system. And so our sympathetic nervous system is where we are our freeze. So if you think of what they always use as a metaphor as of like a bear is in front of you, what are you going to do? Are you going to run? Are you going to freeze? Are you going to fight? And then on the other hand, you have your parasympathetic nervous system, which is where we rest, we digest, we heal, we recover, our reproductive system's working better, all of those things. And so I find almost all of my clients that I see, and this taps into a lot of that infertility piece, is that with society nowadays and the way things are, we are always go, 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 go. And we've got so much happening all the time. And so our body and our biology is shifted into this sympathetic drive. And when we're in this sympathetic drive with high stress, everything is increased tension. Our circulation is not working as well. We have effects on our sleep, our mental health, all those aspects of health that I talked about. And one of those pieces mm-hmm. is the pelvic floor. So as I mentioned, it's not just there, it's everything. And a lot of times when we start to address the pillars of health, we see changes, even if the pelvic floor we haven't started to talk about or to address. Or like you said, there's nothing wrong with the pelvic floor, but there is, right? And pelvic pain, there's so much to pelvic pain. And it's this nervous system piece that I think some clinicians don't realize.
That's amazing. And so can I just clarify, like, the pelvic floor? Because I think when you say pelvic floor, I think of, and I'm sure lots of people do, muscles. I just think of them as a group of muscles. But it sounds like they're so interconnected to so much. I think there's a lot of interesting research that I'm aware of, which is sort of the connection between the mind and the body. Is basically, we used to separate the mind and body. We're two separate things. And what goes on in your body is, you know, it's very separate. But actually, they are completely interlinked.
Yes, they are totally related to each other.
Yeah. So, but that is that right? They're just pelvic floor is just essentially, like, biologically, it's a group of muscles.
Yeah. So the pelvic floor, I would say, is the muscles, the ligaments, the fascia, and the pelvic organs. So if you think, I don't have a pelvic model with me, but you have on the front your pubic bone, so that little bone at the bottom of the base, and then on the back you have your tailbone, and then on the sides you have the hip, the sit bones, which is those bony parts of your bum. And so it's kind of like a hammock, and that is the pelvic floor muscles that are in through that area. And there's three layers of your pelvic floor muscles. So the first layer of your pelvic floor muscles are on the outside, so what you see through the vulva and the vagina. And then we have the internal muscles of the pelvic floor, and that's when we would do an internal assessment to see vaginally what's happening and assessing deep pelvic floor muscles. And believe it or not, mm-hmm. we call them pelvic floor muscles, but there's over 12 different muscles there. We just kind of lump them up as that one group of muscles. And then you have the ligaments. So those are, if you think of, let's say, a boat that's on the dock, when you have the kind of ropes tied to the dock and they're slinging to support it, that's the ligaments in our body to support everything with the fascia. And then the fascia, connective tissue, an easy way for me to help others picture it, if you think of chicken, you know that white stuff on chicken that you see that kind of peels off?
Yes.
Kind of like very on the skin. Yeah, kind of on the skin. That connective mm-hmm. tissue is a part of the pelvic floor region as well. And then you have the organs. So the organs, you have your bladder, for women you have the uterus, and then you have the rectum. So that all falls within the pelvic floor if we're thinking of what is a pelvic floor. So it isn't just muscles, but it's all of that. And as you said, it's all interconnected, and there's so much interplay between everything and how it works. And so between the low back and the front. And so go ahead.
So if a person is experiencing pain, if a woman is experiencing pain, how would this woman know whether to visit a physio or a gynecologist?
That's a good question. Yeah. And the reality is a lot of them just go to a gynecologist. Here in Canada, you don't need a prescription to see a physiotherapist. So you can just go and see one. So I think it just comes down to who they're accessing for care and that way it is wherever you are geographically, because it is different probably per country. So here in Canada and in Ontario where I work, I would say so there's two ways. One, we just see clients who come in and say, I have pain in through my pelvic region, and we start to work through it because it's a big area as pelvic physios that we can address. And then half of them are probably going through the medical system, starting with their family doctor, which then gets a prescription to go see the gynecologist. And then from there, they tend to refer to the pelvic floor physio. So I would say it's not really one or the other. It's usually collaborative in nature and taking both approaches. It's just a matter of where you start depends on who you're asking and what you know from starting off with. I don't know if that answers your question. Great.
Yeah. And then we're going to talk about later on, we're going to talk about endometriosis, and you're going to tell us what you do, because some gynecologists are not doing that. Right. Yeah. £10,000. Could you tell us about the fertility issues? Like, how are these connected to pelvic health, and what kind of issues do you usually come across?
For sure. Before I dive into that, I just want to mention one other thing when we talk about the pelvic floor and our inner core unit, because it's an important anatomy lesson. And I think it's helpful for just your listeners to learn about it.
No, definitely.
And then I'll dive right into the infertility piece. So I'm going to do a little bit of a visual because it's helpful. So you won't see my face, but you'll see a bit of my body. We have our inner core unit, and it's made out of four muscles. And these are the muscles underneath your six-pack rectus abdominis muscles. So on the front here,
my huge six pack.
That's six pack.
The
muscle.
What? Oh, yeah. There's one pack at the moment.
I don't have a pack.
There's one. Yeah, go on.
Sorry, go. So you have this corset muscle, and it wraps around, and that's called your transverse abdominis muscle underneath our six pack muscle, which we all have, just in different levels of conditioning. And then at the back end of it, along the spine, you have what I call your Christmas tree muscles, which are your multifidus. And they run up segmental along each vertebrae of the spine. At the top, so that would be here, you have what's called your diaphragm. And that's a breathing muscle, and it's in a dome shape. And so when you inhale, the diaphragm actually comes down. And when you exhale, your diaphragm comes up. And then at the bottom, you have the pelvic floor muscles that we were just talking about. And so the pelvic floor muscles and our diaphragm with the other two are synergistic. So that means they work together in nature. And so, as I mentioned, our diaphragm comes down, our pelvic floor lengthens and relaxes. And then as you exhale, the diaphragm comes up and your pelvic floor contracts. So we inhale to let go and we exhale to engage. So if we were doing pelvic floor muscle training, commonly known as Kegels, which Kegels isn't the answer for everything, and we'll talk about that as well, but that's the motion of how we would work through the range of motion of your pelvic floor muscles. And so it's about both phases of it and doing it through your breath, and why breathing is so important, which goes back to that jaw piece. And how that's also interconnected. So the pelvic floor isn't just here. It's so much more. And that's why when you work
it's everywhere.
It is. And that's why breath is so important, because it's a part of that inner core unit.
Unbelievable how much we don't know, Shanti. I'm just thinking, wow, my head is exploding. Yeah, go on.
So I'll leave that there for now, and we can dive into things like, is Kegel the answer, when Kegels aren't the answer, and why I don't like to use the word Kegels. But let's dive into the topic of infertility, because that's a common area that I work with, and it's a hard area for a lot of women, because a lot of times they come to me and they feel like they have no hope, and they've tried all these different things, and they've been told so many things, and they don't know what to do. And it, again, for me, it goes back to, I'm not treating a condition, I'm really treating a person. And so often when you're seen by a gynecologist, they're just looking what is happening at the condition. And yes, you may have something going on like PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, or endometriosis, but that sometimes isn't just it. And there's so much more, and that's where pelvic health comes into. So, for example, if we are looking at PCOS, and I'll define what PCOS for our listeners. So that's polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's a hormonal imbalance, happens during your reproductive years, and commonly there's irregular periods and decreased of those opportunities for fertility where the egg goes to the sperm. And yes, that is a hormonal issue which goes into the endocrine system. But I'm sure you all know, like, I have some friends who have PCOS and had no troubles conceiving. Mm-hmm. And then I have some who have PCOS and have troubles conceiving, which goes to show that, yes, there is something endocrinic system that needs to work on. And that's why seeing other clinicians are important. But then there's also things that we can do in pelvic health. And so it talks a lot about our hormones. So we have a hormone that's called cortisol. And cortisol is very important, and it goes back to our nervous system. So you're going to see this is all kind of interconnected as we go along. So cortisol.
It's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. It's so cool on how amazing our body is and how when it's not, what we can do in so many different ways. So we have cortisol, and what happens a lot of times with women that I see with infertility, their cortisol is not working properly in the sense that they have too much of it or at the wrong times. So for example, cortisol should be low when we're going to bed so we can go to sleep. But oftentimes if we're so stressed and there's tension and we've been watching screen for 2 hours, everything's going to increase that cortisol level or having a high sugary food before bed, which is not going to make you want to go to sleep. And we know how important sleep is for our body and getting our 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep. That is where we have our reproductive system working well and we're healing and recovering. And so it's looking at the pillars of health when I'm talking about infertility with women. And so how are they sleeping and how can we optimize that? So going through a lot of sleep hygiene, talking about their gut health and their nutrition, knowing that they need to get their fruits and veggies and making sure that their microbiome is working effectively, which then taps into other clinicians such as a naturopath. Then talking a lot about the nervous system, which is then connected to the pelvic floor. So yes, this PCOS is an endocrine issue, but then often I see pelvic floors that have increased tension, meaning they're protecting that area for whatever reason it may be. And so there are a lot of manual techniques that we can help to work through that piece, along with the other pieces that I have already mentioned that are more of just a educational consultative type role. And so from a manual perspective, it's looking at the pelvic floor muscles that can have, what I say, increased tension. Sometimes there can be true tightness, which can be another reason for infertility with things like vaginismus, which means that the pelvic floor muscles are truthfully hypertonic, meaning they're tight and there cannot be penetrative intercourse because the penis cannot insert into the vagina, which of course would cause issues because we need to have that in order to have the sperm go to the egg.
Step one.
Infertility, right? Step one, exactly. So there's that whole physical piece, but then there's also tension in the pelvic floor. And so tension in the pelvic floor just means that we're guarding and we're protecting that region for a number of reasons, and getting to the root of that is part of what we do in pelvic physio as well and having those conversations. But it's learning how to relax and lengthen that pelvic floor. So as I mentioned, our pelvic floor, so if I use, let's say, our bicep, because that's a common muscle group that we all know. So a bicep should lengthen and then should be able to contract. And often when I see women who have infertility, there's increased tension, meaning they're stuck here. And so it's not about strengthening, because how functional is this? Like, we can't do anything here. We're stuck. And we can't get strong, right? The muscles can be weak and tight. And so what we need to do is learn to relax and let those muscles go and then contract. And by doing the pelvic floor contractions, it also works on the circulation piece. So one of the main roles of our pelvic floor region is a sub pump, which helps with circulation and blood flow in through that area. And a lot of women with infertility, I find, tend to have congestion. So if you think of like a boggy, swollen ankle, and there's just a lot of stuff in there, same thing with the pelvic floor. And it's clinical. Like, this isn't a diagnosis, I need to be clear. But things just aren't moving as well. And it's not that it's stuck and I need to like massage and release it and we need to do dilators, and we can talk about that afterwards. But it's about learning why are we protective and how can we learn to let go and release that tension and connect with that region. Because so many times we don't even know about our pelvic floor and we don't even know how to connect with it. And so that mind to body piece and bringing that awareness and giving them that hope, knowing there's all these other areas that we haven't even explored yet. That all tends to help so much. So there's that piece of the pelvic floor. Go ahead. Sorry, I know I'm going on and on.
Love that. I do feel that many women, including myself, feel that it's me, That's one. And there's something below, down there. I mean, there's no connection at all. I'm going to ask something which may sound fully stupid. And I'm sorry for that.
No.
Just came up now. Does the growing and tightness there link to pelvic floor, or is it something completely different?
I need some clarification. What do you mean by growing? Like us getting older in age?
No. The growing is the muscles. So what I'm thinking is our sport and how tight we are down.
Oh.
There. Does that have
our really tight abs that we mentioned earlier?
Yeah.
Yes.
Does this have anything to do with that, or is this?
Yes.
Shall I?
No. Let me try to dive into it, and then feel free to interrupt me if you want to further ask more questions or clarify in there. But so I haven't had a child. I fall within like before 30, and I was also a very active person, and I even did dance. So dance and gymnastics is a big one that I see with this, who've been told to suck everything in and tighten everything in through that region. And so any of those high active sports where you've been holding on in tension there because you think that's how you're strong, that's not necessarily right. And that disassociation. So what you're saying is completely accurate. And then these young women are coming to me for pelvic pain or for things like an overactive bladder. And so an overactive bladder is when you feel the urgency to go pee frequently, which would be more than 5 to 7 times a day. And each time you're voiding, it's for just a few seconds, which it should be 8 to 10 Mississippi seconds long, a normal bladder void. And so the reason is the bladder and the pelvic floor work together. And if we have everything tension, then those all work together. We have tension, we have an overactive bladder, and all of those different pieces. So that is something very common that I see with young women in sport and who are athletics in, or even dancers, because dancers is a big one, because they've been told that they need to tighten everything up. But it's just like any other muscle group. Like, we're not going to keep our bicep tight here. That's not going to work well. We need to have its full range of motion to be able to do something. And so it's using your breath through your movement and doing things like blow as you go or just talking and counting, because that engages the breath and you're not doing what we call the Valsalva, and we're bearing down and pushing, which then goes to the whole CrossFit thing with women. And we see like sometimes with women like, oh, you haven't lifted enough until you peed your pants, which is stress urinary incontinence. And some women are okay with that. And if you're okay with that and you want to lift that heavy, then that's great. But if you're dealing with those symptoms and it's not something you want, then pelvic floor physio is an avenue to take and, you know, working through that. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
What's blow as you go? Because you sort of mentioned a few techniques there that I don't know or haven't heard of about
No, for sure. So blow as you go is a simple way to do movement on your exhale. So as I mentioned I'll go back to this model. So when we inhale, our pelvic floor lengthens and relaxes. And then on the exhale, we would contract and engage our pelvic and our core region. And so by doing an exhale on the heavy part of a lift, for example, or whatever movement that may be, you're naturally contracting and engaging your pelvic floor instead of bearing down and increasing what's called intra-abdominal pressure through your intrathoracic region, which is really important for our pelvic organs, which then talks more about pelvic organ prolapse. So there's like so many different things, but yeah, simple.
Well, that's so interesting. That makes sense, because like when you do weights, like you're supposed to breathe out when you push, you know, it's like, or like when you pull, whatever, the exertion is on the out breath.
Exactly.
And suddenly it's like, pelvic floor.
Yeah. And so you are using your pelvic floor when you are breathing and when you're blowing out on the exertion piece. And sometimes people get hung up on it and you're like, when I inhale, exhale, what? I'm so confused. And if it's confusing, I always just say, just make sure you're breathing. Like, just don't do all the time, which is called that Valsalva maneuver, right? Same thing with bowel movements. Like how often when you're trying to poop and you're constipated and you start to like bear down to get that poop out. That's like one of the worst things you can do for your pelvic floor and the pelvic organs, because that constant downward pressure is what our pelvic organs don't like and can contribute to that descent of the pelvic organs. And so it's about learning how to optimize everything in the breathing and things like positioning on a toilet, just to make sure that we're taking care of everything in through the pelvic region.
So really, if you're going to the loo and you're bearing down in that way that you say, and you're doing that regularly, you're damaging your pelvic floor.
I like to stay away from the word damaging just because it sounds so threatening and I don't like it. But I would say it's definitely going to increase the risk of a descent of your pelvic organs if you're constantly bearing down. And research has substantiated that that is a risk for it. Same thing as childbirth when you're pushing. But if you have a once in a blue moon time, then I wouldn't stress about it. But if you're constipated all the time and this is the only way that you can evacuate when you're on the toilet, then that's not something that's good for your pelvic region and a reason to see a pelvic floor physio. So some simple things that I teach women or children, or if I don't treat males, but pelvic physios would tell males, is when you're on the toilet is to just breathe on the bowel movement when you're exhaling as you're trying to poop, or even have a fist and do that when you're on the toilet. There's also the toilet posture. So things like having a stool. Have you guys heard of a squatty potty? I don't know if that's a thing out there in the UK.
I've heard about it. And I was thinking, how is that possible? How is it possible?
So a squatty potty, there is science behind how it works and why it is so effective. And the rationale behind it, and it can be any stool really, it doesn't need to be the squatty potty. They were just genius and first created that. And it fits so nice underneath the toilet. But the idea is you want your knees higher than your hips. So you're in a deep squat position and your feet are supported. So they should never, ever be hanging, and you should never hover over a toilet. So let's say you're out in public and you don't want to sit on the toilet. That's a really bad thing to do. And the reason is when we are in this deep squat position, we allow your pelvic floor muscles, one, to relax, because if you're hovering, you're contracting your pelvic floor muscles. And when you're on the loo, you want to be able to relax that, because when we pee and poop, the pelvic floor muscles need to be relaxed. And then our bladder contracts. And so one, you need to make sure you're sitting. Two, have your knees up. And three, have your feet supported. And the other piece why it's so important, or there's two parts to that, is you have a muscle that wraps around the anus. And that's called your puborectalis muscle. That's one of the many pelvic floor muscles that we have. And that muscle relaxes when you have those knees in a higher position. And then the other piece is the colon, in which when you're just normally sitting on a toilet, it's about a 90-degree angle of the colon, the descending colon, to evacuate. But when you are in a deep squat, it becomes a straight line. So when you defecate, it just slides out the poop. So anatomically and physiologically, you're just...
Irina, your face.
How I feel like then? I just blew did your we... mind.
Yes. So why did we invent toilet seats? We were better off when us... outside, you know?
Yes.
Squat.
100%.
Oh my God.
They had it right in the back of the day.
I'm going to call my mom after this, because she was always telling me, hover over any toilet that's not ours. And I've been hovering for the whole of my life. Continue.
Well, you're about to have a huge change in life and see the impact of sitting on the toilet. And
I'm googling squatty potty as we speak for a prime delivery. Go on, Leah. Continue. Changing our lives.
I love it. See, it's these simple things that no one talks about, but can make such a difference.
Absolutely.
Oh my God.
Keep going. I love that. I just love it. Yes. Keep going.
Yes. Okay, so for toilet posture, that's the big things for constipation. Those are some of the areas that can make such a simple change but can be so different. And for women who don't want to sit on a toilet because they're in public, just put paper towel on top of it, like the toilet paper, and just sit on that if it's a hygienic thing. But that is more important than hovering, because so the way your bladder works, you have your pelvic floor muscles and this is your bladder. Your bladder muscle is called the detrusor. When you're peeing, your detrusor is contracted and your pelvic floor muscles are relaxed. And then when we're continent and we're holding our pee, our detrusors relax and our pelvic floor muscles are tight. Now, if we're trying to push your pee out and you're hovering, you're engaging your pelvic floor muscles when it shouldn't be. And then that can cause a big mix-up with the bladder, which then sends really confusing signals to the brain. And then that can lead to things like UTIs, urinary tract infections, because not all the urine's coming out because you're trying to keep your muscles contracted. And then urine gets stuck in the vaginal cleft. You're not fully emptying, and so there's still urine there. And if you do experience difficulty emptying fully with peeing, there's something called a double void, which is a very simple tip. This is another good one to take away. And a double void is where you sit on the toilet the first time and you're relaxed, because we now know that our pelvic floor muscles need to be relaxed and we're not pushing the pee out. So you're just sitting on there, you're letting everything flow out, you're doing some nice calm breaths. And then once you're done, you're going to stand up, you're going to just shake out your pelvis a little bit, do a little shake dance. You're going to sit back down and then try pee again to see if there's anything left to come out. And that works really well if you do have issues with emptying your bladder and feeling like there's still a little bit left in there. So that's also something helpful when you're using the washroom for a bladder technique. For bowels and constipation, I mean, we could go on and on about so many things like fiber and water and your gut health. And then again, looking at the pelvic floor, if there's tension and how do we work on relaxing and lengthening it. But those are just some of the simple things that I thought I would share and give those pearls of knowledge to all your listeners and both of you as well, and your mom then too.
Yeah.
You're amazing, Leah.
I feel like in the media, if you look up, because constipation is interesting, because obviously people who are like bearing down, people who are pushing, and then you have prolapse and other issues come up. You talk about, people do talk about water and nutrition and gut health and stuff, but actually just being tight, as like your muscles are being tight. I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because I feel like that's something that I'm aware of, but not to the same extent that I'm aware of other things, and how that feeds into constipation. Because, you know, you could be having like for example, so for me, like I get, as I said, like I hold all of my stress there. So if I, you know, if that's everywhere's being tight, then what's actually happening? What's my body doing that I can't quite consciously control? And like what can you do to like relax those sorts of muscles, especially for people who are super fit? What can you do to make sure that everything is like chilling out with
Is it the kegels?
Kegels. Well,
isn't that the other way?
So it's what I call reverse kegels. So in this instance, so with constipation, what I tend to see clinically is those pelvic floor muscles around the anus and the vagina are increased tension, or they are actually tight muscles. And so we need to learn how to lengthen and relax the muscles. So doing what I call reverse kegels. And so what I mean by reverse kegels is, so first let me explain a kegel, because then it'll make sense when I say reverse kegel.
Yeah.
So a kegel is when you inhale to let go, and then on your exhale, you squeeze your pelvic muscles and you lift. So it's not just squeezing the muscles around your vagina, it's actually lifting them up as well. So we grade that muscle just like any other muscle group from 0 to 5. And to have a 5 out of 5 strength of the muscle, you need to be able to do both. And then there's the coordination piece and the letting go. So a fit pelvic floor isn't just the strength. There's more to it. Mm. Now, if we go back to a reverse kegel is the inhale letting go piece. It's the first part. So we don't need to work on the squeeze and lifting part because we know those muscles are tight. We need to work on inhaling and opening that area up. And so using the breath pattern. So even things like diaphragmatic breathing, I say diaphragmatic breathing is the way to massage your internal organs. It's starting to get everything moving on the inside. So that's something super simple that you could start to do. There's even, you can find it, I think, on YouTube. There's a Canadian physiotherapist, and she specializes in pelvic pain, and she does it through yoga. And yoga is really, really helpful. And she has what's called a toilet meditation. And she has an abbreviation for each step. And it walks you through a meditation when you're on the toilet and learning how to relax that region, which is really cool. You can Google it, the toilet meditation. You should be able to find it. Her name is Shelley Proswick. And so yoga is a great way to learn to relax those muscles. And then again, going back to the nervous system, right? Why are we so stressed all the time? What is the root of that problem? And by getting to that and being able to shift our biology into that parasympathetic nervous system, it's going to help with your reproductive system. It's going to help with your digestive system. It's going to help with all of that. So what are ways to activate our parasympathetic nervous system? Meditation, yoga, Qigong, yin yoga, walking, nature walks. There's so much research to say the benefits of even a 10-minute walk out in nature. And it's not like, okay, I'm going for a fast walk. It's changing that mindset of, oh, I'm looking at the birds, I'm looking at the water or the greenery. Just being in nature, there's so many benefits for it. So there's so many ways to address it in that sense as well. And then there's also stretches. So things like a deep squat, right? If you think of a deep squat where your sit bones are, those bony parts of your bum, it's going to spread open in a deep squat. So you could do that against a wall. Child's pose, again, everything's opening through that region and helps stretch that area out. Pigeon pose, I don't know if you know pigeon pose. That's a really great pose to get a deep hip muscle called your obturator internus. It's one of the hip rotating muscles, and I commonly find with deep pelvic floor tension or tightness, that's one of the common muscles that are tight, and a physio, orthopedic physio, would never know that because they can't get into that muscle. And pigeon pose is a great way to stretch that muscle out. So there are some stretches, and then also doing pelvic floor physiotherapy to help work on releasing those areas if they are truthfully tight, and helping you to cue into that. And as I mentioned, we do internal vaginal assessments here in Canada, which is why we're rostered to be able to do that. And so we would find the muscles that have that tension, help you bring awareness to that piece, to do the breath with it. So then you're like, oh, that's how I relax it. And sometimes it's just a light bulb and it goes right off. And then you can do the full, what I call core breathing, where you do both the inhale, let go, and the exhale, contract. Because you need to be able to do both, not just one. And so it's bringing that awareness piece to the areas that your body's just loving too hard and hugging too much, and kind of working through that. And then that's vaginally. And then sometimes with constipation, there's also rectal assessments can be quite helpful as well, because the muscle is more posterior to the back where the anus is, and working through tightness in that area. And then even things like tailbone. So a lot of women come with tailbone pain who also have constipation, and there's some manual techniques to work through mobilizing that tailbone, because those muscles all attach to your tailbone, right? And so working through the tailbone helps to move things, to get things moving freer, so then it can work better. And then that allows everything to move through the colon and then through the rectum and then up through the anus much easier. I don't know if that answers your question. That's There's so like so much parts to it. It's not just like this, but all of that.
No, I think so. But being aware of the options, as like, I think so often if you have a problem, you go to the doctor and you don't necessarily know where that could possibly go. You don't know what possible reasons there could be. And so I feel like if you have an understanding of like, oh, it could be that, so you continue to research and discover rather than just sort of trying something and going, oh, that didn't work. And then sort of just kind of cope, which I think is like when people are so busy, that's the very natural conclusion. Oh, I can't bother to deal with this. Let's just pretend it's not there. I'd love to talk about painful sex and like why that can happen in the first place, and what role you have in that. I mean, we touched on vaginismus, which would definitely be a painful experience, but not just that, just in general, like general painful sex as well.
Yeah. So there's different parts with painful intercourse that can happen. So it can be difficulty with initial penetration, which would be things like vaginismus when the muscles are spasming and you don't allow that penetration. It can be things even before that point, the sensation on the outside of the vulva region. So things like vulvodynia, which is just increased sensitization in through those tissues where it's painful to touch. So having even difficulty wearing underwear, for example, and tight compression garments because it's pressing. And then there can be more so with deep penetration, which is those tight pelvic floor muscles where when the penis or whatever else is hitting in through that pelvic floor and you have that truthfully tight pelvic floor muscle or the tension. So it's pelvic pain in through intercourse can be like a lot of different reasons why. And to address it is, again, multifaceted, as that seems to be the ongoing trend. And there's a lot of ways to approach it and how we go about it. In regards to how these happen, before I dive into how to treat it, there can be a number of different reasons why it can happen. A common one that I work with is women who've had sexual abuse. It is a very common thing that I see who come, usually it's they see a gynecologist, and then that's a very specific referral process to see a pelvic floor physio. And for very good reasons, they've learned to protect their pelvic floor. And as a result, are unable to have intercourse, or it's only painful for that traumatic experience that's stemming from it. And so working through that layer, that can be a reason. Women who've given birth for the first time and are trying after 6 weeks postpartum, they're like, okay, you're cleared, you're good to go. I don't know if it's the same there, but here that's typically how it is. And they're looking to see how everything is physically healed, which, yes, you know, stitches are healed, everything's clear. But what about the pelvic floor and everything else that comes with it? And so, again, you can have those that tension and that tightness in your pelvic floor muscles and the tissues are sensitive. Or you've had an epiphyseotomy or tearing and there's scar tissue around the perineum. The perineum is so you have your vagina and then you have your anus, that little area between the two. And that's called your perineum. Yeah. Usually at 7 o'clock is where we have the scar tissue, whether it's from an episiotomy or from stitches from tearing, and just that physical piece of that can cause painful intercourse. Another thing, especially as you get older, also talks about vaginal dryness, which is it's like, I want to say 50 to 80% of women have vaginal dryness as they get older because of hormones. And again, also postpartum with a decrease of estrogen when you're breastfeeding. And so there are things like lubricants. Lubrication is so important. And I always say, be generous. And there's good quality lubricants, that things that you want to look for in a lubricant that can be helpful. And then there's also vaginal moisturizer. So here in Canada, we have over the counter something called Gynatroph that can help to just lubricate and plump those tissues up. And then if you need more, you can actually get topical estrogen and you would go to your family doctor to get that prescription. But that's also a reason for having painful intercourse, the hormonal piece. So there's lots of different reasons why you can have it and where it stems from. And there's different ways to also approach it and to treat it. But again, it goes back to that nervous system. It goes back to that hypertonic, tense pelvic floor and learning how to let go and feel safe again. If it's something like vaginismus, commonly what I work through are what I call accommodators, also known as dilators. Do either of you know what that is?
No. Dilators. No.
Yeah, I don't have them with me. They're at the clinic. But they're essentially the shape of a penis, and they start with a very small one, like the size of my pinky, and then they work this way up with the width, the length, and also the girth. Mm-hmm. And so we would start to work internally to try to start to help allow more accommodation through that region and kind of getting it to open and doing that with your breath patterning. If it's something like the vulvodynia, then it would be just working on the sensation on the outside and gradually working to those tissues. And it's a very gentle approach because it talks a lot about pain. And then a big piece of this is pain science and understanding why is there pain and how do we work through that. And pain science is actually the first and most important. I should have started with that, really, because when we understand why we have pain, that helps and decreases our pain. So often we feel that there's something damaged, like something's really wrong down there. And then that just creates a cyclic effect that, oh my God, it's not a good thing at all. And that creates more pain. Mm. And then we look at stress and our emotions and we think, oh my God, I've had this and it's never going to get better. And why is this happening to me? And I had an argument with my partner and I can't do sex and I feel bad for him and all these things. And then that just creates more pain and tension. So it is. And pain is an output of the brain. And so what I mean by that is we have our thoughts, our emotions, our belief. We have a signal. So we have whatever that physical pain is that's sent up our spinal cord to our brain. In our brain, we have our thoughts, our emotions, our beliefs, our past experiences, our stress, all of that. And that sends that signal out whether it's painful, right? We can all appreciate, like, if we were, for example, crossing the street and we rolled our ankle, but there's a car coming. Are you going to feel pain or are you going to run across the street so you don't get hit by the car? You're going to run. You're going to make sure you get to this other side of the street. And then you're going to be like, ow, my ankle hurts, right? And so there's a way that you don't experience pain right away because our body's so good at protecting ourselves. And so what happens with a lot of my clients who have pain with intercourse for a variety of these issues and conditions is working through understanding why they have this pain and how can we change it. And so we can change that cycle, and there's so much within our control and understanding that, you know, we can have pain but have no tissue damage. A lot of times the tissues aren't damaged and they're healthy and they're great, and just giving them that time to connect and hear that is so therapeutic on in itself sometimes. And so getting them to understand that process and really diving further into pain. We could have a whole hour conversation on pain science, but it's an ongoing process as we work through it. And we do what's called pelvic floor remapping. And so that's working through internally through the pelvic floor region, and where I'm getting them to tune into an area that they're, like I said, loving too hard, hugging too tight, where we have that tension or that true tightness. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting them to connect with it and giving them the permission to let go and feel safe again. And it's okay to feel sore, but know that your tissues are safe and that they're not damaged. And we do that throughout the entire pelvic floor internally. And as they work through it, they start to feel better. And then they feel better. They have these positive experiences that gets less pain. And they know that, oh, my tissues aren't damaged. That's less pain. And then you're having all these positive reinforcements. And that helps. And then there's also the component of our threshold of pain. And so often with these clients, we have what's called central sensitization, in which it's not even just pelvic pain in through the internal piece, but now you have it in your low back. Now you have it in your knee. Now you have it in your hip and your ankle. And it's kind of spread in different regions, which we call smudging. And the reason is our body has been sensitized. So before we could have pain that goes up to here before we experience pain, now our body can only tolerate this much before we have pain. And so as a result, there's not that increased capacity and threshold of pain, and we're going to slowly build it back up and desensitizing these tissues and novel movement patterns and that novel touch with the pelvic floor remapping. So yeah, lots of areas. The nervous system is really key and working through that pain science. And then again, the pillars of health, those other pieces as well.
Wow. Pain science is so, like, pain is crazy. It's so nuts. It doesn't, like, people, like, with chronic pain as well, like, just thinking of, you know, when there's no, like, psychosomatic pain, where it's like, I have pain, there's no reason to have, there's no, like, physical reason to have pain.
Yes. And
we all expect there to be a physical issue where there is pain. That's so entrenched in, like, I think our education. Like, that's pain science is, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. And I think it's being able to shift that thought that, okay, yes, there's nothing physical, but your pain is real and it is something. It's not in your head, because I often get that too. And there's so much that happens chemically and biologically in the brain, science-wise, and our brain is so plastic, meaning that it can adapt and change, sending new neurons and new signals and firing those patterns. our brain is just good at doing the most efficient thing. So if we've been so used to having pain, that's the cycle that's going to go because it knows it the best. But as we start to have these new firing signals and these new thoughts, then that will start to work on that one. And then it can shift. So there is potential to shift that mindset and to shift how much pain and what that feels like. But it is a big step, and sometimes it's easier said than done. And it takes a lot of time to delayer that. And also having been told by so many different clinicians and doctors that, okay, well, you have pain, but there's nothing there. So I don't know. I can't do anything for you.
Yeah.
But there's so much that we can do.
Yeah. I mean, there's such – so I don't know if this necessarily completely applies, but I've like – There's like a bit of science that I've read, which is like part of it is just like not denying it, it's the pain's there, but just being like, you're not going to stop me from doing what I want to do. So like I remember a few years ago, I got really bad lower back pain. And whenever I trained jiu-jitsu, it would like seize up. Mm. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And I remember then I couldn't train properly for a month or two because I was just like, every time I'd go and train, I'd just be like, I'd suddenly, everything would seize and I'd be in pain. And then one day I just was like, I was talking to my sister about this because this is something that she read a book. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to entirely ignore it. And then I went training and I just completely ignored it because I was like, there's nothing wrong with my back because I know I've been checked. Mm-hmm. And after a week or two of just going and being careful but ignoring it, it just vanished. It like just completely disappeared, and it was just like, wow, like I've had pain which I got really freaked out by because it's my back, and there was nothing wrong. Like how, like what was going on? Like how, yeah. And it's like when the pain moves, it's like if the pain moves from one part of your body to another part, then you know that it's like, okay, you're just finding a new home. Like it's not something wrong with that part of my body. But I think we were going to ask.
Good point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that my experience, I get psychosomatic pain quite a lot. It's like, oh, hello.
Yeah. It's awesome. Like I said, right? It may be sore at first, but it's safe to move. And by giving a little bit, gradually doing more and more, your body realizes, oh, this is okay. This is fine for me. And then you get back to doing it, which goes even to concussions, right? The same thing, that gradual progression of adding things back in. It's the same thing with whatever your injury is, really. It's, you know, gradual progression and overload to allow your body to adapt, because our body is so great at adapting. It's just giving it the opportunity it needs and doing it at the right progression, that whatever, depending on what you're experiencing. But you're totally right. Yeah, it's working through it. It's not that I'm never going to do it, because movement is so important. Motion is lotion. The more we don't move, the worse it's going to get. And the more we move, the better it's going to get.
Wow. Motion is lotion. I like that.
Well, we learned so much. By the end of these two podcasts, we're going to be like, wow.
And share it with everyone. That's really what I'm trying to do is I find every time I have these conversations, it's like, oh my God, I never knew this. And it's some of this is such easy things to start to put and integrate into your life and can make such a positive impact. And it's just, why isn't it more out there? And why I whole started this whole thing. Just educating others.
I think one of the most difficult things is to know where to look for help. So let's say you've got a problem with maybe pelvic pain, and we all go to our GP, but our GP, you know, they might not be up to date with the most latest research. You know, in different countries, they might not have access to certain things, or you might have to go through completely different channels to get to where for you in Canada, you can just straight book to a physio. In the UK, you have to go through a GP, then your GP refers you on. So it's part, and if the GP sort of decides what they think is best, and then maybe you don't ask why and you don't ask about the options, you'll never know.
And also you have to wait a little bit.
Oh, months, years.
you have to be dying to go straight away to the physio. That's what I've realized in this country.
Oh, boy. Cool. You do have a lot of amazing physios in the UK that I've connected with through social media and Instagram. So they are out there, and there's lots to reach out to. I just think it's, like you said, is educating the primary healthcare So educating the GPs so they know better. And there are some that are fantastic and there are some that aren't. And as I mentioned, this is generally a new area. Like in Canada, 2012 isn't that far long ago. And we know that it takes about 10 years from things in research to go into practice. So I think it's so variable on depending on who you are, but being like you are your best self-advocate. And having come across whatever research it is or whatever podcast you've heard and knowing these things, it's asking those questions, because if they don't know, they will help find the answers. And if you're not happy with it, go to someone else. Do not feel happy with, you just got to live with it. Because so often with pelvic health, that is not the case. There is so much that you can do. And sometimes, and something that I've learned with my concussion is you have to be your biggest self-advocate because you want yourself first. And sometimes you need to kind of ask those questions and write them down before you go into your appointment and do some research before. But I also understand that it depends on the person and everyone's different. And I mean, I have so much education that I know what to ask. So you bring a really good point that I hope changes with time. I know, for example, in France is amazing postpartum. I don't know if you know, but they have after 6 weeks, they go see a pelvic floor physio for 12 weeks. It's a part of their plan of care there. Like that is their practice, which is amazing. Every woman who has a child should see a pelvic physio because there's so much to address. Like things like returning to running because you don't want to do that right away. And we didn't get into that today, but we'll talk about that more next podcast. But I think it's just really depends on where you are and who you have and what they know as well, the GPs.
100%. Definitely. And what you said about, you know, if you're not happy, just go and see another specialist is so important. Because people think that, oh, I'm talking to a specialist. They know what they're talking about. I don't. So I'm listening to whatever they say. And that's the biggest issue there. Because it was a case where, like, I've heard so many different cases about a wrong diagnosis. Do you know what I mean? Like it's, they're human.
They're human. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. They're specialists in that area, which is a very small area. So often I talk to specialists and they're like, oh, I didn't know all of this stuff. And so there's so much more beyond where they have. And so it's looking to those other areas as well.
Definitely. And trusting your intuition. I think there's so much to be said, like,
yes.
Don't get, you know, going in. If you know something's not right, you've got to just go in, have a little think, and then you can come back. Because I think our intuition can be so on the money. Like, it can really know what's going on.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for part one.
Part one, yes. We're not going to ask what are you fighting for, because it's not the end of us talking to you. So this is going to be the see you later moment.
We loved it.
It was very fascinating because there were so many different elements we never thought about, and you already made an impact. And this isn't published yet, but Squatchy Potty is on its way. It's going tomorrow.
By the time this is out, Marina
will have to let me know.
We can do a review.
You have to let me know afterwards.
Yeah.
Maybe by the next podcast, Marina will have it and we can revisit.
Of course I will. Tomorrow. Yes. It's going to be there tomorrow.
That's amazing.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast. And credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk and check out our website for more content.